Today on Vox Talks, the story of inequality in everything except income. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Amartya Sen famously made the distinction that doing well was not the same as being well. But when we measure trends in inequality, we tend to compare people or countries based really on who's been doing well. We use changes in income per capita over time to do that. Can we measure the long-run changes in inequality in being well instead? And if we do, will it tell us a different story? This is the ambitious challenge that Leandro Parados de la Escosura of the Charles III University in Madrid and the CEPR has taken on in a recent paper with a result that might surprise you. Leandro, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, team, and thanks for having me here.
As I said, we do tend to measure well-being and inequality exclusively by per capita income at the moment. Why do we do that?
This is a very good question. Although economists often accept that development is multidimensional, they assume that any dimension of well-being is highly correlated with income per head. Mm. In fact, this is Kuznets' view of the 50s. GDP is a measure of economic welfare in the long run. Even those who claim that GDP is a flawed measure of welfare come to the conclusion that is GDP per head is informative of welfare, so has a difficult solution.
If we do that, though, what do we know are the long-run trends in inequality for per capita income?
There is agreement about a sustained increase in global economic inequality. I mean, inequality among wealthy citizens since the late 19th century that only declined mildly since the early 2000s. So if you approach it from a broader perspective, and you get a very different response.
Yes, you approach this instead from the capabilities perspective. That was pioneered by Amartya Sen, but you don't hear a lot about it in economics at the moment. What does this try to capture?
Amartya Sen, he went a step ahead development scholars when he identified well-being with the ability to lead the life one has reasons to value, to quote more or less exactly. So freedom of choice makes the difference between the capabilities and other approaches. And this is the inspiration of human development, as you know, defined as a process of enlarging people's choices. However, in practical terms, the HDI failed to satisfy Sen's concept because it didn't include freedom of choice. And let me just tell you a personal anecdote, diverting a little bit from our conversation. When the first time the HDI was released in 1990...
That's the Human Development Index, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. I was terribly disappointed to see that Spain, my own country, rang high in 1975, when the country was still under Franco's dictatorship. Mm. And a similar paradox appears if you look at the case of Cuba, for instance. So I realized that something was missing in the Human Development Index that betrayed its concept.
The problem is, though, that you can't really measure this freedom, this capability directly, can you? So how can we possibly proxy for it?
You're again right. Capability is a very elusive concept to be captured in an empirical measure. For instance, avoided ignorance or avoiding premature death are capabilities, and using sense terminology, and living a long and healthy life or having access to knowledge are achievements. But how to proxy them is a real challenge. The only evidence we have is, in the best of cases, in the case of access to knowledge, is years of schooling. And to proxy a long and healthy life, all we have is life expectancy at birth or similar measures such as high infant survival rates. To make things more difficult, since capability is about freedom of choice, I decided to add another dimension that encompasses positive and negative aspects of freedom, a measure of civil and political liberties, which combines political liberties and civil liberties.
You're an economic historian, so you're interested in the long run. How can you get data for all of these things that captures that long-run perspective? Yeah,
I was expecting that question, Tim. There are much more data, believe it or not, than the average economist think of. there is more than just the latest international organization data released online. And there has been a sustained collective effort by historians and social scientists over the last several decades to provide evidence on education, on health, on liberties, in addition, as you know, GDP, the famous Madison Project, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I have collected the best available data for this project.
Now, when you get that data, you then have to create indices for life expectancy, for schooling, for political and civil liberties. You have to transform what can be quite small changes in the data into meaningful changes in the indicators. I know this was a problem. It's often been under discussion in the creation of the indices in the HDI as well. How do you do that so that you consider that changes are meaningful?
Well, let me tell you that how one uses data matters a lot. But in practice, most scholars use the raw and transformed data of social dimensions of well-being. Mm-hmm. And this may lead, for reasons I will explain now, to misleading interpretations. There are two important issues. Unlike GDP per head, most proxies for well-being dimensions are bounded. For example, life expectancy at birth has a physiological asymptotic limit, as people doesn't currently live beyond, say, 85 on any country on average. And even in the most backward societies, people's life expectancy at birth is above 20 years. So this means that when you use the original values, you run into trouble because absolute increases of the same size represent a much larger improvement at low levels of, say, life expectancy than at high levels. Just consider 10 years improvement in life expectancy at birth when your life expectancy initially expectancy is 30 years, or if it is 70 years. So in the second case, the change is smaller relative to the initial level. But there is a much more important element, which is that life expectancy or years of education are just crude proxies for something more ambitious, a long and healthy life or access to knowledge. So these proxies don't take into account quality improvements. Mm-hmm. And we know, at least from available evidence for the last three decades, that more years of life expectancy and schooling imply higher quality, not just quantity, of health and education during childhood and adolescence. So when you transform this non-income dimension, these social dimensions, you have to allow for two facts, that they are bounded and their quality improves along quality. And this, just to end this long answer to a very precise and short question, I'm using nonlinear, actually convex, transformation designed by the distinguished economist Nana Kakwani, in which an increase in the standard of living, life expectancy, you name it, in a country at a higher level implies a greater achievement than would have been the case had it occurred at a lower level.
Now, you've also aggregated these together into an index of augmented human development. How can you aggregate these things together?
Well, let me first apologize for being so pretentious, calling it augmented. but, you know, I was trying to think how to sell it to an audience of skeptical economists and social scientists. So aggregating well-being dimensions or simply using a dashboard of them, you know, just listing them, has long been debated. I mean, if you look at the World Bank or someone such as Martin Ravalian, he would favor a dashboard. And the main reason is that economists object to aggregation because they find no theory underlying it and find also the implicit trade-off unacceptable. However, let me tell you that well-being dimensions, when you study them in practical terms, diverge and aggregation mitigates this problem. More importantly, well-being, human development, any of these concepts are difficult to capture because they are latent variables. Mm. So the sum of the dimensions add much more information than each of them taken individually. A second issue is a practical issue, is how to aggregate them in the augmented human development using an arithmetic or a geometric average, weighted or unweighted. Until 2010, the UNDP, a human development index, used an arithmetic average. And then they shifted to a geometric mean because the rationale was that each dimension of the index was indispensable. And then you need to reduce their substitutability, Just to give you an example, you have a dictatorship in, say, an oil-producing country, and for some reason, the dictator represses brutally the population, killing thousands. But at the same time, oil revenues go up. So one thing can offset the other if you use an arithmetic average. But if you use a geometric mean, this doesn't happen, or not to the same extent. But the main criticism, perhaps, is the high trade-off. For instance, in rich countries, if you look at the marginal rate of substitution, you realize that life expectancy is valued much more highly in terms of income in rich than in poor countries. And this has been used as a main objection. However, if you think in terms of capabilities, what the message is that in countries of high income, increases in income represent a very low contribution in terms of human development. Okay, so it's the other way around.
I would recommend that all of you download the discussion paper because you go into great detail on how you make these adjustments and how you then make those aggregations. But we have to move on and we have to look at what you found out. If you are going to look at inequality in these indices that you have constructed, how does the progress of inequality compare with inequality in GDP per capita?
Well, as an economic historian, I'm naturally eclectic, and therefore I decided to address each dimension of well-being individually, and only then looking at augmented human development. So for your sceptic or our sceptical readers, they can skip the part about augmented human development. Okay. So here, you know, I don't have information for within countries, unfortunately, but we see for income and for a recent period, there is a very close correlation between trends in what you would call population-weighted income and global income inequality. Why? Because usually differences between countries are much larger than differences within countries. Okay, so I have to make this caveat. So in terms of population weighted inequality, if you look at schooling, inequality fell steadily since the 1920s. In the case of, say, life expectancy, there was an increase in the late 19th and early 20th century, but there is a sustained decline from the late 1920s to the 1980s. And in the case of political and civil rights, things are different, but there is a decline only after 1970. In any case, these results are at odds with those derived from income per head distribution across countries, as I told you, because there is a sustained increase up to the 2000s. Moreover, I would say there is a substantial difference between dimensions and well-being and per capita income is that if you look at the gains for each percentile over these 150 years, consider in the case of well-being dimensions, the middle and lower deciles of the distributions are those who gain most, whereas in the case of per capita income, is the middle and especially the top deciles. So I think this is important to stress. And now if you go beyond distribution, you will realize that non-income dimensions of well-being evolve differently from income, and their phases of acceleration do not match.
Can we tell from the data what is driving these reductions in inequality? Is there a simple story that we can tell about that?
Yes. I mean, if you look at immediate and ultimate determinants of inequality, the immediate determinants would be the gap. Is it very interesting? The gap between what we call today advanced countries and the rest of the world was what drove inequality in well-being until the early 20th century. But then it took dispersion within the rest took over. But of course, it's much more informative to look at the ultimate determinants of inequality. So let's look to each of them quickly. In the case of schooling, obviously, it's caused this reduction in inequality by the widespread of primary and secondary education, which was largely, has been largely a result of government intervention, often stimulated by many things, industrialization, war, redistribution. But it's not driven, as people have suggested, by democratization. In fact, more often, it's by nation building. I mean, this purpose of homogenizing population to forge a national identity through a common national language and mass public instruction. In the case of life expectancy, the story is completely different because the pace and the breadth of the diffusion of the so-called epidemiological transition determines the evolution of inequality. The epidemiological transition consists of decline or these gains in lower mortality and higher survival achieved as infectious disease gives way to chronic disease as the main cause of death. But this was originally linked to the diffusion of the germ theory of disease. And it's interesting, the historical finding I got. Usually, economists think that everything, the whole epidemiological transition, took place after World War II, because it's when drugs were distributed internationally and international organizations stepped in. But in fact, the story starts much earlier, because the spread of the germ theory of disease not only implied the emergence of new drugs, as we know, as a result of advances in medical technology, but improvements in public health, often at low cost, and the diffusion of something important, which is preventive methods of disease transmission and knowledge dissemination through schooling. So life expectancy started increasing, surprisingly, during the so-called globalization backlash between the beginnings of World War I and 1950, which was, as we all know, a period of economic distress. And furthermore, in the developing world, these advances took place when these countries were still under colonial rule. Okay, but let me tell you why inequality changes. Because these achievements resulting in longevity, resulting from the epidemiological transition, were not shared equally across countries. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lack of economic means and scientific knowledge that prevented a fast and wide diffusion. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, what you have is an increase in life expectancy inequality associated to the fact that this is unevenly distributed because it's restricted to the advanced world. And then from the 1920s, to the 1980s is when you have this universal diffusion. However, things have changed after 1990, and this is a surprising result, because inequality stalled and even increased again. And it's not just the impact of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, or the consequences of the demise of socialism in Eastern Europe, but it's also the consequence of a second health transition that so far has been restricted to the West, which, as we all know, is related to reducing mortality and morbidity among the elderly as a result of new medical knowledge that improved treatment of respiratory, cardiovascular diseases, and so on. And finally, in the case of civil and political liberties, there are two competing versions, but I think they are complementary. On the one hand is the so-called theory of modernization. So to the extent economic growth spreads, inequality in terms of liberties declines. But it is also the international set, the international environment, which is subjected to geopolitical events. So, for instance, the spread of authoritarian regimes between the early 20th century and the 1970s that took place in parallel to the spread of democracy explains the high dispersion. And the collapse of authoritarian regimes, both right-wing and socialist, account for the decline in the late 20th and early 21st centuries.
On Vox Talks particularly, we've worried in previous episodes about the rise in income inequality. Your long-run perspective has a lot of lines in inequality that are downward sloping. Should we be more optimistic about what's happening to inequality in the world?
The answer is yes. Perhaps we should look beyond income and therefore beyond what we could call primary inequality, which is income distribution in the world, and focus on how other dimensions of well-being are distributed. I'm an economic historian. I'm not an expert on policies, but I think this information is an input for politicians and administrations' decisions about priorities. Because you can say, well, how to make people happier? And as we all know, subjective well-being, which is something difficult to tackle from a historical perspective because of lack of data, but tell us that we pay more and more attention on how people feel and how they feel about their well-being. So I think perhaps this kind of information will complement the focus simply on income.
This is part of a bigger project, isn't it, Leandro? What are you attempting to achieve?
Well, let me dream. This is part of an ambitious project. I won't even dare to say it is actually the first part. And this ambitious project is to study the evolution of freedom, both negative and to investigate the extent of a trade-off between them. As you know, we often implicitly assume in our daily life there is a trade-off. sometimes, you know, there is this clash between providing access to resources that allow people to enjoy their freedom with defining freedom as the absence of coercion and interference. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the long run, my hypothesis is that there is no trade-off. And you can see that freer societies in terms of negative freedom, in terms of absence of coercion and interference, are also those that enjoy higher levels of positive freedom, access to resources that allow them to enjoy their freedom, even though there are short-run episodes in which a trade-off appears. So the first part of this project that deals with human development and its dimension, which is therefore basically a measure, but not completely, of positive freedom, will appear in book format, hopefully next year at Cambridge University Press. And I do a bit of advertising here. And then I will continue working on the more arguable side, which is negative freedom, including economic freedom.
Well, as you say, Leandro, we're a long way from the economic mainstream today, but it's been a really interesting journey. Thank you very much for taking it with me.
Thanks to you for your patience and with my talk and my accent. Thank you very much, Tim.
I'm fascinated by this, and I hope that a lot of you will be as well. It's discussion paper 15853 at the CEPR. It's called Inequality Beyond GDP, A Long View. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks. You never miss an episode when you do. And remember, there are 12 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.